Okay, folks, I guess let's get going. 2 o'clock. So the fourth installment of this course, second last class. While I'm thinking about it, yes, same time, same place on Monday, 2 o'clock here, and then that'll be it. So yeah, in terms of today, the fourth class, I want to talk a little bit about the finite element method. Getting a bit more prominence these days in 3D numerical modeling, the finite. Initially, it was integral equation. I'll talk more about that in the last class. Then it was finite difference method. Nothing wrong with finite difference method by any means. But people are starting to look a bit more at the finite element method these days. So one or two publications appearing on that. And so I want to talk about the finite element method today. Again, just going to rely heavily on the 1D problem, just because we can explicitly write stuff down for that. And it's perfectly fine to, you know, the concepts that we use. I mean, now in the 1D situation for the finite element method, we have to use the concepts that then get used in 2D and 3D to derive things. For the finite difference method, we could use our intuition and just kind of write down straight off the top of our heads the approximations. Not really so for the finite element method. We have to kind of just build things up from scratch, even in the 1D case. So this illustration or this 1D example will work fine as an illustration of the concepts that are used in multi-dimensions. So back for the finite element method, we do start at the same place, the differential equation. For electric fields, again, the 1D MT problem is what I'm looking at. Differential equation, our Earth model coming in through here, simply the X component of the electric field, the function is Z. That's what we're after. And just as one always does for this numerical modeling business, and kind of back echoing what I talked about in the first class, first off, discretize our Earth. You know, we have to get things in terms of sequences of numbers, piles of numbers that we can get our computer to do the arithmetic with. So this will be our discretization of our Earth model. So layers, again, Z is left to right, just for ease of drawing. No nodes for sure appearing on this diagram, just simply at the moment thinking about discretizing the Earth. And so this will be the highest layer interface. This is layer 1, has a connectivity layer of sigma 1, uniform connectivity in this layer as before, layer 2, layer 3. Say the ith layer, sigma I, top of that layer, z subscript I, bottom z subscript I plus 1, all the way down to z, big N. So I've got big N number of, no, I've got big N minus 1 layers. So that's, you know, seen that before. That's going to be our discretization of the Earth model, discretization of the Earth. Now, you know, we have to think about discretizing our electric field. It was at this point for the finite difference method where we explicitly start thinking of nodes. Okay, let's pick specific points at which we're going to try and figure out what the value of our approximate electric field is at those points. In contrast, for the finite element method, we start off by explicitly thinking of, okay, we're going to represent our approximate electric field by some linear combination of basis functions. So right off the start, we're thinking of this very explicit representation. These basis functions, in principle, exist over the whole range of Z. In reality, most of the basis functions that people use are non-zero for a certain range and then zero everywhere else. You know, but in principle, they exist over the whole range. So we've got here an approximation for electric field, you know, that's explicitly true and valid for the whole range of Z, in contrast to the finite difference, where we're very much thinking of just the electric field at discrete points and kind of sort of forgetting about what happens in between those points. So here we go, starting point for the finite element method in terms of discretizing electric field. These phi subscript i's are the basis functions. It can be all sorts of things. There's some typical, there's typical ones that are used. I'll talk about that in a moment. These are just the coefficients of the basis functions. I mean, just numbers. Typically, what people do is they choose their basis functions. In particular, they choose the normalization of the basis functions such that these things are equal to 1 at particular places, which means that usually we end up having these coefficients actually corresponding to the value of the electric field at certain places. So that's why I'm using E as these coefficients, because, yeah, they're going to ultimately correspond to values of the electric field at specific locations. So that's what these comments here are. And just in terms of examples, I mean, these basis functions can be anything. They could even exist, be non-zero over the whole range of Z. But by far and away, the most common way to do things is to have your basis functions such that they're non-zero over a certain range and zero everywhere else. And in particular, because we discretized our Earth into layers, then it makes sense to have our basis functions be zero only over one layer or perhaps a couple of layers. So that's what I'm going to do here. And so let's start off by looking at the first basis function. It's going to be non-zero in layer one, zero everywhere else. And let's just have it so that it is this straight line, this linear variation that goes from a value of 1 at z1 all the way down to 0 at z2. So it's a very specific linear variation, very specific basis function. This is the actual sort of formula for it. And because of this specific normalization, which means that this basis function is 1 here, then it does mean that coefficient e1 in my expansion is going to be ultimately the value of the electric field at z1. Anyways, this is basis function number 1. Does equal 1 at the left-hand end. And you know, definitely equals 0 here. The consequence of this is that this basis function is continuous at z2. Its derivative is not, but it is continuous. Okay, that's going to be my first basis function that I use. In terms of phi 2, I'm not going to go for just like some linear variation, straight line variation in layer 2. What I'm actually going to do, this is completely standard, is actually go for this triangular basis function. Goes from 0 at z1 up to 1 at z2, and then decreases back down to 0 at z3. So this nice little triangular basis function, 0 everywhere else. And that's my phi 2. Again, nicely chosen. So it's 1 here. It's 0 at these two endpoints. Very particular choice. Remembering what phi 1 was, which was just this straight line down here, then the value at z1, the value of my approximate electric field at z1 is going to be equal to phi 1 there and has no contribution from phi 2. Likewise, my approximate electric field at z2, because phi 1 was coming down to 0 here, my approximate electric field at z2 is going to be completely due to phi 2. So again, this is why those coefficients that I have in my linear expansion for the approximate field are actually the values of the electric field, my approximate electric field at the nodes, at the layer interfaces. Again, just sort of to belabor the point, basis function is continuous everywhere along here. Okay, its derivative is not, but the basis function at least is continuous. And so we can just continue with our set of basis functions. For example, this would be phi subscript I, this would be layer I minus 1, kind of this would be the z subscript I. So each of these basis functions, rather than sort of being associated with a particular layer, is actually associated more correctly with or more usefully with a particular node. So phi subscript I has its peak at the ith node, at the ith layer interface, and then slopes off linearly on either side. So that's particular example, particular choice of basis functions for the 1D problem. It's pretty typical. Not the only one, but it is pretty typical. So here, for sure, we've got this very explicit linear dependence of my approximate electric field between the nodes. You know, in contrast to the finite difference method, where there's nothing explicit said about the electric field between the nodes, but kind of as soon as you introduce a finite difference approximation for derivatives, you're kind of assuming that, yeah, that's just a linear variation between the nodes, and you're ignoring higher order terms. Here we've got this very explicit statement of linear dependence. And we made, you know, by construction, by choice, we've made it so that our approximate electric field is continuous at each node, at each layer interface. I mean, this is good because going back to class 2 on the rules and regulations, we know that for our 1D Earth and our EX, it is going to be continuous across boundaries between layers. And by construction, we've made it so that our approximate electric field here in this finite element solution just has to be continuous across the layers because that's what the basis functions do. So that's good. Just by construction, we're satisfying one of those rules and regulations. Comment here, which I mentioned before, even the for the finite difference way for the 1D problem, especially when you choose your nodes to be on the layer interfaces, then you're kind of doing the same thing. You're just by construction, you're getting an approximation that is continuous across the layer interfaces, which is good. But we're sort of thinking of this explicitly in the finite element method. So that's kind of the main crux in terms of the setup. Now we can actually go ahead and just do stuff. So back to the differential equation that's describing what our electric field is doing in our particular setup, the 1D MT problem. So, you know, I've got a very explicit representation for my electric field, so I'm just going to substitute it right in there. So now I've got the second order derivatives applying to my basis functions and the coefficient out front. And again, my basis functions appearing in here, and with the pulling the summation and the coefficients all the way out to the left-hand side. So that's just simply substituting in expression for my approximate electric field. Because it's approximate, this equation will no longer hold once I've substituted in my approximate electric field. So I'm going to just recognize that fact by introducing this residual term here. You know, it's a function of z that just indicates that, well, this stuff here is now an approximation of my differential equation. But there we go. We've taken our approximate field, stuck it into the differential equation, and we're on our way to getting our finite element solution. So just repeating this equation here. This is still just one equation in big N unknowns. Where big N is the layer interfaces. One equation in big N unknowns. So the next stage is to try and get from this to a system of equations. It was at this sort of point in the finite difference method, at the equivalent point, we'd approximated the differential equation. We'd got our d2 by dz squareds, and we'd said, OK, let's replace that by this finite difference between three neighboring nodes. But in doing that, we were thinking very much of a particular node in our whole real line of z. So in introducing the finite differences for the derivatives, we were explicitly thinking of doing that for a certain triplet of nodes. And that would give us an approximation for our differential equation at that point. Then we'd do it for the neighboring triplet, get another approximation. Neighboring triplet, get another approximation to the differential equation. And that's what gave us our system of equations, just by thinking locally of our approximation to the finite, to the differential equation. Here we haven't done anything locally yet. We've got this expansion for approximate electric field that, you know, is kind of valid for all of z, being, okay, we've made a particular choice for phi that are zero for most of that, but in principle, these are valid for all z. So we haven't done anything sort of local yet to give us, you know, a sequence, a system of equations. So what we're going to do is kind of going to do something that's sort of equivalent to the finite difference method, where we look at just, say, a triplet of nodes, triplet of nodes, triplet of nodes, to give us an approximation for the differential equation at those locations, and then each of those approximations goes into our system of equations. Instead of explicitly looking at a bunch of nodes, we're going to do that in an average kind of a sense. Certainly at start, later on it'll become more explicit as to what that average is. But what we're going to do is we're going to multiply through this equation by a weighting function and kind of require that this equation be satisfied in an average kind of sense when we think of that weighting function as defining that average. So a little bit more on the specifics of that in a moment. This is called the method of weighted residuals in general. I prefer this way of thinking about things. I find it more comfortable. There's a completely different way of setting up the system of equations for the finite element method. One name attached to that is the Rayleigh-Ritz method. It's very much, its line of thinking is, okay, we need to find a functional such that once you minimize that with respect to perturbations in the electric field, hey presto, you get your differential equation. And if you then take that functional, substitute in our approximate electric field and do the minimization with respect to the coefficients instead of the perturbations of the electric field, then oops, out falls your system of equations. I find that a bit complicated and a bit involved. So I like the method of weighted residuals, which I'll talk about in specifics in the next couple of slides. I'm not sure about that. I think each have their own line of reasoning. So this is the one equation that we have in n unknowns, and we're now trying to move towards a system of equations. And so in this method of weighted residuals, I'm just going to choose some weighting functions. I'm going to call them psi, j. And at the moment, who knows how many of these we might have. We'll worry about that in a moment. But I'm going to come up with these weighting functions. I'm going to multiply through this equation by, you know, say, psi j, so one of these particular weighting functions. So that gives me this term here with this psi j now, pre-multiplying each relevant term. And then I'm just going to integrate this over the whole of the z-axis. And so that's kind of the averaging that I'm talking about, weighted by specific weight function. So here we go. These are the three terms. The second order derivative, respect to z, pre-multiplied by the weighting function, integrating over the whole of the z-axis. This is the connectivity term. Basis function, pre-multiplied by the weight function, integrating over the whole of the z-axis. And I still got my residual term floating around here, pre-multiplied by the weight function, integrated over the whole of the z-axis. So again, just you know, one equation still at the moment, but for this one particular weighting function. So the argument then goes, you know, I've got this residual floating around because this is an approximation. So the reasoning then goes that, well, let's choose our solution. Let's choose choose the numbers that we come up with for our electric field to be such that the residual that we have, because that stuff's an approximation, the residual that we're left with ends up being orthogonal to these weighting functions. Which really kind of means that in an average sense, when our averages are being weighted by these weighting functions, that this residual is zero in an average kind of a way. That's the reasoning behind throwing away that term. So there you go. I'm also doing this, you know, ultimately for all weighting functions that I have. Practical concern is that now that residual term has gone out of this equation with hopefully some good reasoning. So now I'm at this stage where, again, still just one equation at the moment in my n unknown coefficients in my expansion for the electric field. You know, now it involves integrals and it's got weight functions in here. So this is, you know, one equation in the n unknowns, but I can do this for any number of weighting functions that I choose. So let's choose, you know, at the moment I'm saying, okay, let's say there'd be m weighting functions. Let's choose a number of weighting functions to be equal to n. That's going to give us a square system. Also, sort of the most common, not by no means the only way to do this, but sort of the most common way to do it, known as the Glerker method, is let's just take our weighting functions to be the same things as our basis functions. And for sure, that will give us a square system. So we're then, you know, in contrast to the finite difference method, where we're coming up with an approximation to the differential equation for each triplet of nodes, we're now effectively saying here that we want our differential equation, once we've got our basis functions in there, to be satisfied in an average kind of sense over the domain of each of these basis functions in turn, which is every sort of pair of layers. So kind of the same as for the finite difference, but more in an average sense because we've got these integrations happening. So Glerker method. So based on that reasoning, we now do have a system of equations. You know, so it's hidden a bit, but specifically thinking of j going from 1 all the way up to n, as well as I going from 1 all the way up to n, we do now have n equations in our any unknowns. So hey presto, we've got our system of equations. I can turn it into a matrix, times vector equals right-hand side, stick it in the computer, and hey presto, ultimately hopefully get a solution for our electric fields. Or, oops, coefficients of our basis functions, but yeah, okay, that's the electric field at the nodes. So yeah, I mean, this term in here, this integral, okay, we kind of have to do that given what these basis functions are, but, you know, if we choose these to be these p piecewise linear things, then yeah, we can kind of do that. That's not too difficult. And oh, wait a minute. So those basis functions that I showed you at the start, which are the typical ones, you know, piecewise linear, if we actually take the second derivative with respect to z of any one of those, they're just going to vanish. They're going to give us zero. So it's like, ugh, everything was looking so good. So this then becomes a sort of classic point within the finite element method where people start talking about, and again, I'm not 100% understand these, but sort of like the weak formulation. So instead of a differential equation, you're thinking more of sort of an integral kind of form that's the weak formulation. So terms like that start to get thrown around. But basically, what that is to do with is what's happening to this term when we've got a derivative that's of high enough order that if we were actually to apply it directly to our basis function, then we'd get zero, we'd be in trouble. This second order derivative term came back from, you know, it originated from our d2z squared of our electric field. And so the second order derivative with respect to z of our electric field is not necessarily going to be zero. So the fact that this is zero is purely because the basis functions that we've chosen are not real electric fields. They're just an approximation of the electric field. So if this were an electric field in here and not a basis function, this term shouldn't be going to zero. So we can't just have it drop out, of our numerical solution. So we're going to have to look at this and fudge things a bit, manipulate things a bit. This is sort of a classic step in the finite element method, whether it's 1D or multi-dimensions. So just looking at that one particular integral in detail, so I've got my weight function, that okay is a basis function, times the second order derivative of my basis function. And at the moment, I'm just going to think about integrating this over one particular layer, so the ith layer. I'm just integrating by parts, because it's this second order derivative that's causing the problems, and I want to move one of those derivatives out of here and stick it on my phi j. So this is just integration by parts. Go from d by dz squared, get one of those d by dz's over here on the phi j. We've got this boundary term here. I'm going for a slurp of coffee, sorry. Integration by parts. We've kept everything here so far. I mean, this is perfectly exact. No approximations happening at this stage. In terms of the stuff on the right-hand side, we've got the basis functions being differentiated once. And that's okay because these are linear, and so derivative of a straight line with respect to z is going to give us, you know, a constant, but hey, it's a non-zero value, so that's okay. So then there's this other term floating around that we need to now have to deal with, because this is looking better than that, so that's good. But then what do we do here? Calling this the surface term, because if you're doing this in 3D, this integration by parts is happening for volume integrals. So this here and that there would be volume integrals, and this term ends up being an integral over the surface. So that's why I'm kind of using the term surface here. But if we look at it, and I'm going to sort of draw the picture again, so just repeating this integration by parts, this is just the picture for, say, the ith basis function and what it's doing, its little triangular tent-like feature to it. And just for reference, d by dz of this thing, let's see, positive slope, so it's going to be positive d by dz of some value here, negative slope over this side, so this would be the, so basically this graph here, piecewise constant, shows d by dz of phi. So this is the term that I'm looking at. I'm wanting to come up with an argument as to why I can neglect this, so that's where I'm trying to get to. This integration by parts here is just for this layer. And so ultimately, I'm going to need to do this over the whole of z. So ultimately, there's going to be integrations over all of these layers, just to try and set the scene a bit. So at the moment, this stuff is happening on this layer. And so if I look at the basis functions, then for sure, by construction, phi i plus 1, any of these basis functions is continuous at these nodes, at these interfaces between the layers. So if I start looking at what phi I is doing at one of these endpoints, then either it's going to be equal to 1 or it's going to be 0. So phi j at either here or here is going to be 1 or it's going to be 0. In terms of this z derivative, so it's a bit awkward like this. So it's going to have, you know, it's not at all continuous from one node to the next. What's going to happen when I start looking at integrating over the whole of the z-line, not just over each layer? So when I start including this integration from each layer through everywhere, I'm going to get these terms, say, for example, at z. I'm going to get these terms at z that came from integration over this layer, but I'm also going to get terms from this thing that came out from the integration over this layer, and they're going to be of the opposite sign. So the fact that phi is going to be continuous is starting to hint that the term I get out of this at this point from this layer is starting to look as if perhaps it's going to be the same size but opposite in magnitude to the same term I also get here but from this integral. So that's the argument that I'm using. I'm trying to get these things to cancel, the contribution coming from this layer and the contribution coming from that layer, both at that point. The thing with phi is that, yeah, it's continuous, so those terms will cancel. This d phi by dz, it's not continuous, so those parts are not going to cancel. However, I'm desperate to get rid of that term. If we were to sort of step back and continue sort of an argument, hoping, keeping fingers crossed, you know, all these derivatives originally come from this equation that's applying to my electric field. So kind of remembering where it came from. And so if this was d by dz of an electric field, a proper electric field, then d by dz of my electric field gives me my H field. And I know that my H field, and again, 1D MT problem, so the H field is going to be in the y direction. So I know, yeah, it's going to be continuous across a layer interface. So okay, my d phi by dz, the d by dz of my basis function, is not continuous across a layer interface. But if this were the electric field, which I'm trying to approximate, if this were the electric field, this term in here would be the H field, and yeah, okay, it would be continuous across here. Okay, so that's the argument that I'm using to say that, and I'll just go back one slide. Whoops. So I can point at this line again. So basically, I'm going to say that, well, at this particular point here, I'm going to get contributions from this surface term here due to the integration over this layer, and they're going to be cancelled exactly, in principle, by the contributions at this point due to the integration over that layer, and this is going to be happening because phi is continuous and, okay, d by dz of phi is not, but I'm going to say, oh, it should be the H field, and it's continuous, so okay, yeah, those terms will all cancel at that particular node. So that certainly sounded as if it came out nice and confused. I'm not sure if it, which means that it probably reached you a nice confused state. Did that make any sense whatsoever? I mean, the other argument, the other reason I desperately want to get rid of this term is, you know, this thing's an equality, right? And this thing, if this is my basis function, you know, it's a linear term, it varies, it's a straight line, so that thing is zero, no matter what. So that's zero, which means that this term is equal to that term. So if I were to try and keep both of these in my finite element solution, then both of these would cancel, and, you know, because the left-hand side is zero, that side, that's the sum of these two is going to be zero, so there's no way I could keep both of these in. I have to throw away one term, otherwise I end up with a big fat zero. So all this stuff that I've been trying to say for the last 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes is really just to justify throwing away this, which is something I have to do anyways. So bottom line is, I'm going to go back to my system of equations, and the terms that involved the second order spatial derivative of the basis functions, I'm going to replace them by this expression, where it's now sort of this product of first order derivatives. And it's at this sort of stage where people say, well, this is kind of the weak form of that. So basically after that confused description. This is now my system of equations. Got your integral, basis function, weight function, connectivity. You're over the whole of Z, but these are just non-zero in certain layers. And now instead of this second order derivative with respect to Z, I've got this product of first order derivatives. So this then is what this term ends up being. So that there is the system of equations that are needed that we're going to solve for a finite element solution for the 1D MT problem, where I'm explicitly choosing my basis functions to be these nice little tent-like triangular basis functions that are non-zero over two neighboring layers, have a value of one at the layer interface. So that's that. We can write it again using the same sort of notation as I did in class one, first class for the finite difference technique. You know, system of n equations and n unknowns, I'll stick those n unknowns into my vector. Those are the values of, those are the coefficients in my expansion for the approximate electric field. But because of the choice of basis functions, that ends up being, yes, the values of the approximate electric field at the layer interfaces. The elements in this matrix here are just coming from these terms. L is coming from these terms. So again, we can just set up our matrix equation. Corresponds to the system of equations. So I think I'm just describing this in detail here. And so this is an example. Looks suspiciously like the picture I showed you in class one. That's because the picture I showed you in class one, and hence this picture, is in principle from a finite element solution. The thing is, for this 1D problem, if you do the finite difference method, choosing the electric field, or going for the approximate values of the electric field at the layer interfaces, if you do it one way, or if you do the finite element method, where you do the expansion that I showed you, where you've got these little tent-like basis functions associated with each layer interface, then by the time you get to your system of equations, it ends up being the same system of equations. So that's why I could use the same picture, the same examples for both. Just a couple of comments about the situation in 3D before I stop. The concepts for coming up with a finite element solution in 3D are exactly the same as what I showed you for the 1D situation. Instead of integrating over the real line, it's now volume integrals and surface integrals, but there's still an integration by parts because you've got a second order derivative that doesn't work on your basis functions usually, unless you choose some really sophisticated basis functions. So the same things apply. Just one slight example. So in 3D, for example, an example of basis functions that were chosen by people in the early days of 3D EM modeling that didn't work, and then a new choice, I mean, not new, it's, I don't know, 10, 20 years old, that was a lot better for EM. So just indicating that choice of basis functions are important. So this is supposed to be a subset of, let's see, 8 cells buried within the mesh somewhere. Let's see, X, Y, and Z. So this is just looking at, and of course in 3D we've now truly got our vector field, so we kind of need to have a set of basis functions for each component of the electric field, or think of basis functions themselves that have directions to them. So this is supposed to show you one basis function for the X component of the electric field, so X in this direction. And if we were to look at this plane, through this horizontal plane through this this group of 8 cells, and just draw the arrows on them to indicate the direction and the strength of the basis function, then these were known as nodal basis functions. Oh, okay, and if we look at this horizontal plane, this is a picture we get. If we look at a vertical plane, then it's the same kind of picture because it's the same variation. It was nodal because this basis function is effectively centered at the node that is in the center of these 8 cells, nodal elements. This particular way of thinking of a 3D vector element, vector basis function very much parallels this triangular business for 1D, where my little triangular tent basis function is centered on a node. So this basis function is centered at this node. It's non-zero in these 8 cells, but it's zero everywhere else. And it's actually chosen to be zero on the faces of this 8-sum, this octet of cells. It's also chosen so it's equal to 1 at the center, and it varies linearly in all 3 dimensions. So it varies linearly in Y, varies linearly in X, and it varies linearly in Z. It's all kind of all fine and good. It sort of gives us a 3D variation valid over this small subset of cells. Looks like it might be a useful basis function. Oops, I didn't have any statement. Okay, the one problem with this thing is that if we now have our Earth model, and for example, these 4 cells here have a different conductivity from those 4 cells there, then from our rules and regulations for EM, we've got this jump in continuity from the left-hand side of this octet to the right-hand side of this octet. So, okay, current density, normal current density is continuous. Okay, conductivity changes. Oh, okay, so normal electric field is going to be discontinuous in that situation from left-hand set of cells to the right-hand, so the left-hand quartet to the right-hand quartet. But by construction, these nodal elements, these nodal basis functions, are most definitely continuous across this interface, just simply by construction, just like those 1D ones that I showed you, the little tents, triangular tents. I mean, they're continuous, just simply by construction. There's no way that you can get the tent coming up this side and then having a jump and then coming down that side. No way it can happen. So these nodal finite elements, nodal basis functions, people tried them, and sure enough, it was found that, yeah, they did not work when it came to EM modeling, especially in the Earth, where we have variations in connectivity, just because they don't satisfy the continuity and normal component of current density across interfaces between different connectivities. What people use these days are these edge elements. And now it is, say, one particular edge element. So viewed the same thing, now in 4 cells, first looking at a horizontal slice, then looking at a vertical slice. So okay, this particular vector basis function, non-zero in these 4 cells, zero everywhere else. It now does not vary in the x direction, which is good, which means that it's going to have a zero divergence, which is good. It also varies linearly away from the central edge. They're called edge elements because now this basis function is perhaps more usefully associated with this particular central edge, in contrast to the previous ones, which were it made sense to think of them as associated with the central node. So that's why these are called edge elements. The critical thing is that there's no link in terms of basis functions, in terms of construction. There's no link between this basis function in this quartet of cells and the basis function in the neighboring quartet of cells. So these basis functions are quite happy to support a discontinuity in the normal component of electric field across an interface between 2 different connectivities, which is not the case for those nodal finite elements. So this is how people tend to do things these days. I think I'll leave it at that. So again, I haven't described the 3D situation very much at all, but definitely went through the 1D situation, illustrating the concepts that, yeah, get used in the 3D case. Okay, let's see, one exercise for today, which in principle is, hey, code up a 1D, or code up a finite element solution to the 1D MT problem. It ends up being the same system of equations, so arguably, just have a look at those integrals, maybe stare at them long enough that you can convince yourself that, yeah, with those particular triangular basis functions, and if I did the integrals, then actually, yeah, I'd end up with the same expressions that I had for the 1D finite difference setup. So, looks like a full-on exercise, but it's not really. Sorry. Oh. I tried to make it so it would last 3 weeks, but no, it won't. And as for conclusion slide today, the take-home points, I mean, finite element method for sure uses a very explicit representation of the electric field right up front, in contrast to the finite difference method, where it's kind of implicit. To set things up, sure, the finite element method, the starting point for the finite element method is still the differential equation, like for the finite difference method. However, to set up the system of equations in the finite element method, we're doing this business of inner products with weighting functions rather than just introducing finite differences. Almost always there's this sleight of hand that happens with this integration by parts to move things around a little bit and get a weak form of the equations. That's just the way it is. And as you've probably gathered from today's class, the finite element method to set up, to actually derive your system of equations, you know, is more involved than the finite difference method, certainly for simple problems, for which you can just think of intuition to set up the finite difference problems. However, when you start getting to 3D, and if you're ever going to think of meshes in 3D that are not nice cuboidal cells, then it becomes a lot less clear what the finite difference method should be, what your finite difference system of equations should be, whereas the finite element method, the concepts, the sequence of steps that I went through today, you know, there's nothing really about them that are that have to have a nice rectangular mesh, for example, to work. Basically, the concepts for the finite element method are quite happy to work for any weird and wonderful unstructured tetrahedral mesh or any kind of weird and wonderful system situation. So the finite element method is sort of more widely applicable in that context compared to the finite difference method, which is great for the obvious intuitive situation, but for more complicated situations is a bit more difficult to think about. Okay, so that's it for today's class. Thanks, folks. Any questions at the moment? Or any comments along the lines of, finite element method sucks, for heaven's sake, look at it, it's terrible. Who would ever want to do that? I mean, the main reason people are starting to look at it these days is that some folks are wanting to move away from this rectilinear mesh where you've got all the cell boundaries normal to the three Cartesian coordinate axes. Some people are trying to move away from that into these unstructured tetrahedral meshes or other kinds of sort of more general meshes. I kind of want to do that just because I've seen enough 3D models from geologists and sort of exploration scenarios where, you know, they've got a wireframe mesh of their ore body, which has been, you know, they've drilled it enough that they kind of know where their intercepts are between the various rock types, so they can come up with sort of a weird wireframe mesh of their ore body. And so when we geophysicists come along and say, can't you put that onto little cuboidal cells, please? Then we kind of get a stare of, that's a stupid idea. So it'd be really nice to be able to do the geophysics on these weird and wonderful unstructured meshes that the geologists are using. Or that's what I think, and that's what I would like to have a go at. But I haven't done it yet, so we'll see. And it's for those kind of meshes that the finite element method sort of comes into its own, shall we say. Whereas if you're trying to do a finite difference solution for that kind of mesh, it's pretty hard to figure out what the discretization should be. Not that you can't, but it becomes difficult. Then there's the integral equation method, the classic integral equation method, which we'll talk about on Monday. But until then, no questions. Good, okay. I guess it's Friday and it's the afternoon, and isn't there a pub in Dublin somewhere, I heard?